This is the Business Report with Gary Strubel on Nova 1035.
A poem by Gary Strubel. Hey, hey, it's Thursday. Welcome to it. It's the Business Report here on Nova 1035. And we've got a whole host of great stories for you this week as we take you around the country and catch up on the biggest stories of the week. David Bishop caught up with Sam Shavuti. He's the NAMRA commissioner on a fascinating story about initiatives that NAMRA is bringing to bear to try and rein in the tax cheats and make sure that the tax net is a fair one. Then Martin Nkumbi, he's the CEO of the Development Bank of Namibia, joins us in the spotlight. An interesting song choice from Martin. Stuart Lohman catches up on all things South Africa and tells us about Cyril's new plan for energy production, and also a great story about Comair. Then Dino Bellotti, who is the SME Development Innovation and Acceleration Head at the Namibia Investment and Promotions Development Board, joins us to talk about Know to Grow High Potential Pool to support high potential micro and small businesses. So if you run a little business and you'd like to know how you could access some of that funding, listen out. That's Dino Bellotti coming up. Now, before we get into all of that, let's start out with the BizNews Flash Briefing.
Rebuilding the economy starts now. RMB Namibia Corporate and Investment Banking, proud partner of BizNews.
With your BizNews, I'm David Bishop. The Public Service Union of Namibia has called on public servants countrywide to vote in favour of a strike against government over the alleged failed wage negotiations, saying that the strike is necessary to bring about improved conditions of service and inject necessary cash into the economy. Embattled South African state-owned power utility Eskom says its energy transition plan may require as much as 1.2 trillion rand of investment for new generation and distribution capacity, with the bulk of the money expected to come from private investors. Meanwhile, the executive director of South Africa's Presidential Commission on Climate Change called the country's coal industry delusional on Wednesday, saying that in their view, the coal market is going to drop off radically in the 2030s and particularly after 2035. And in what could be good news for Namibia's uranium industry, more than a decade after the Fukushima disaster shattered confidence in nuclear power, Asia is undergoing a nuclear renaissance as China, South Korea, Japan, India, Pakistan, and even Taiwan, where Asia's anti-nuclear sentiment remains most entrenched, are rushing back to the low-carbon energy source as an accelerating climate crisis, soaring energy prices, and energy security concerns eclipse previous safety fears. I'm David Bishop. Stay tuned for more updates.
A sudden storm shouldn't disrupt your long-term outlook. Access RMB's flexible short-term liquidity. Rebuilding our economy starts now. RMB Namibia, a division of First National Bank of Namibia Limited.
Gary Strubel on the Business Report.
Welcome back. Time for the lead story, and the lead story is proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future. Now, for our lead story this evening, it's a story that really affects every citizen in the country, and it's about tax. Namibians don't seem to have a particularly high tax morality. In other words, they would much rather not pay their tax than pay their tax. And David Bishop catches up with Sam Shavuti, who's the NAMRA commissioner. Here's David.
We're talking today to Mr. Sam Shavuti, the CEO of the Namibia Revenue Agency. Hello, Mr. Shavuti.
Good morning, David.
Now, you've said that Namibians don't have a very high tax morality. Why do you think that is?
Well, that is informed by the statistics and the data that we have. Because if one look at our tax base of about 800,000 people, and out of that, only about 52% are compliant, then it can only show you that there could be an issue with tax morality. And also, if one look at it as well, whereby the individual taxpayers, they contribute and pay more taxes than companies, something is not right.
Is NAMRA planning any kind of public education campaigns to explain tax and the need to pay it as well as about how to go about making sure you are compliant to try and change this?
Yes, definitely. When we developed our strategic plan, we devised about six strategic objectives, And one of our strategic objectives is that of improving tax compliance. But under that strategic objective, then we developed what is called a stakeholder engagement. So we have been to a number of regions. We have been to the northern region. We've been to the southern region. We've been to Maheke region. Last week, I was in the two Kavango region, but that's Kavango East and Kavango West. As we are talking today, my team is in Okahanja. Yesterday, our team were in Epukil because we have what is called the operating model. And our operating model calls for, first, you'd want to educate the people. Then the second leg of the operating model is service. We need to make it easy for our people to comply. And of course, you have the third leg, which is enforcement.
Speaking of morality, could you maybe just explain what the difference is between tax evasion and tax avoidance and what penalties and charges individuals or companies could face in each of these scenarios?
Okay. The difference between tax evasive and tax avoidance, there's a very thin line between the two, but tax evasion is illegal. When we talk about tax evasion, this is someone who would under-declare or who will just fail to pay or to fulfill their tax obligation. That is evasion, just refusing or evading to pay. Now, tax avoidance is a legal way of reducing one's tax liability. For example, you will have cases like sometime management fee where businesses or individual will try to inflate their expenses so that at the end of the day, there will be no much profit whereby they will have to pay taxes. Or they will have something like a trademark that they will buy from a related company. And as a result of that scheme, you would then this business would not have made a profit and therefore they will not be paying the tax that's supposed to be paid to the state. But the one is illegal, that's evasion, while avoidance is not illegal.
So you say that it's not illegal, but obviously it means less money for the fiscus. Is NAMRA looking at sort of changing some of the loopholes and closing these avoidance opportunities?
Oh, yes. Even our Income Tax Act, for example, specifically Section 95, it have a provision that says that if there is a scheme that is aimed at postponing or avoiding taxes, then the commissioner or the Minister of Finance in the past, but now the commissioner can then ensure that proper assessment are done and that should be stopped. I think with our current enforcement and compliance strategy, those who are indulging or who are taking part into tax evasion or tax evasion, we will be in a position to pick them up and bring it to the halt. It's not going to happen in one day or in one year, but of course it will be a process. But we are doing whatever is necessary to make sure that we capacitate our auditors, we develop investigative capacities, and going forward, it's not going to be business as usual.
With NAMRA having come into its own as an agency on its own, sort of standing alone from the Ministry of Finance, how have things changed? Have we seen the level of tax being collected increase since NAMRA came into existence?
Oh yeah, definitely. NAMRA was launched on this by His Excellency Dr. Hage G. Geingob on the 7th of April 2021. Already in our number 1 year, our target of tax revenue that we ought to collect was 49 billion. And we collected more than 52 billion. So we already exceeded our first target with 3.5 billion. And I think that's a positive sign. And we did that without being where we're supposed to be, because there's still a lot of groundwork that need to be done in really building a strong foundation for this institution.
I want to step back just a little bit. You mentioned that one of NAMRA's pillars was making things easier for the consumer, for the taxpayer. What initiatives is NAMRA then embarking on to encourage Namibians to file tax returns and ensure that they are in good standing?
Okay, what we are like I said, on the basis of our operating model, we're doing a lot of education. Like I said, we're doing more education than we have done before. That's one. We're encouraging people to file on an integrated tax administration system. That's also another one. We're doing more audits, and we were also able to pick up a lot of loopholes and also fraud that has been committed against tax revenue or the office and so on. So there's a lot of things that are happening that are all aimed to ensure that the state revenue is not compromised or it's not compromised. Yeah.
You've also been running many amnesty programs whereby penalties have been waived to encourage people to sort of pay their back taxes. How successful have these been in achieving their aims?
I must say it has been very, very successful because like the tax relief program that just ended on the 31st of January 2022, that one we have seen about 47,926 taxpayers participating in that program. That by participating, we mean registering on ITAS, e-filing, then also paying their capital and also 25% of interest. Because with the first program, 75% of interest was waived and 100% penalty were waived as well. So 47,000 is not a small number. Of course, it's about 5.6% of the total tax base. But also, we have also collected about 1.3 billion Namibian dollar in 12 months. And we have also seen an amount of 11.1 billion in penalty being waived. You can see the relief from the Namibian people or Namibian business people, 11 billion that they supposed to have paid and it was waived. So I think people have to appreciate the government for doing that great thing.
You're talking about that 47,000 who have registered with ITAS, obviously as part of this amnesty program. Other than that, how has ITAS been taken up by the public?
I should say, ITAS was launched in 2019. And with 2019, of course, with a new change, with a new system, especially moving from online to digital, it's not always easy. There will be some resistance, but I think we have made some progress. As I'm talking to you now, about more than 300,000 taxpayers of our total tax base of 859,000, they have signed up on ITAS. So that's about 35% of the total tax base. So 35% have already signed up. And I think with our strategy of continuously engaging and making service available to the public member, including those who may not have access to internet, because what we are doing, we have what we call e-filing and portal registration. So in all our regions, even someone who does not have access to internet, they can walk in and the portal registration, they will be able to help them. So we are also opening on the 1st of August, and this is news to the Namibian people. On the 1st of August, we are opening what is called Namra Dedicated Service Center, just close to the Ministry of Finance where the procurement office unit used to be. So that's Namra Dedicated Service Center. But you also see us coming up with a pop-up station as well. And we will take this service to the people. We are opening up Namra satellite office, mobile office in Opuo. We'll open in Opuo as well. And I think we are really committed to make service available to the people because like we say, after educating, we need to serve with passion and make our service available to the people and make it easy for people to comply. Then after which we then move to the third leg, which is enforcement.
Getting away from the income tax element for a while, Namra was, of course, in the news quite a bit recently following the confiscation and destruction of counterfeit goods. I know that you explained it at the time, but could you perhaps recap why this was done?
Okay. In our Custom and Excise Act, there is a provision that ban all counterfeit goods, because counterfeit good is never good for any economy, because it can be medicine, it can be car parts, it can be clothing and so on that infringe someone's intellectual property. Now, since independence, since 1990, counterfeit goods has always been confiscated by the customs officials. And when it's confiscated, then they then work together with brand right holders. And later on, when it's then determined that this is counterfeit, the only disposal method that is provided for in the law for counterfeit is destruction. So the destruction has been taking place over the past 31 years. So what happened on the 10th of May 2022 was no different from what has been happening over the past 30 years. But now a false narrative was created. Number one, it was reported that NAMRA have banned goods of Namibians or of those who do what is called order with me. Truth be told, up to today, David, no one in this country will give you evidence that NAMRA have banned goods. The goods were disposed in a method that they used to be disposed in the previous year. But in the previous year, there were also some good, special fake medication that was banned. Now, those who reported on this destruction and not having attended the destruction, then shown a visual image of goods being banned of previously, even before the launch of NAMRA. Now, some opportunists then try to create a false narrative saying that NAMRA have banned goods of the ordinary Namibian people. The goods were apparently confiscated from the Namibian people who are just trying to make a living, including those who are in the business called Order With Me. And we have the statistics and the data with regard to what was confiscated. And much of that which was confiscated, 99% was not even confiscated from Namibians. But even if it was still with the Namibian and being confiscated, there is a law. And in an ordinary society, you need to ensure that laws are enforced, because we're in tax administration and our work is to enforce the law. But now this false narrative that was created by some opportunist that we have banned the goods of the Namibian people, things were just taken from the Namibian people. Some people, and unfortunately this includes some well-educated people, they fell for this narrative. And when they fell for this narrative, then NAMRA become a victim, and people want to paint a picture of NAMRA as a monster or as an institution that does not care. But all those that came up with this false narrative, what they do not know or what they need to know is that Namibia Revenue Agency is an institution which is there to serve for the best interest of Namibia and the Namibian people. All the revenue that we collect does not even go to a NAMRA account. It goes straight to the state. So when we wake up, our mandate is very clear: to collect the revenue on behalf of the state, to enforce tax and customs law, to provide customs and excise services that facilitate legitimate trade. Because remember, David, no goods would come, get imported or exported from Namibia without being cleared by customs. Now, we are also having an obligation and a responsibility to protect society. And sometimes that's why I say that our mandate is so big. It can be comparable to a certain extent to the Namibian police, because we are at all border posts. We are at all entry point, at all airport, at all the ports. And any goods that is coming in or going out have to be declared. And our mandate of protecting society is to make sure that illicit goods, including illicit firearms, drugs that are destroying our society, do not come into this country. And people need to understand this mandate and to know that NAMRA is not what was described by those who created a false narrative to score cheap political points. NAMRA is here and is going to be here to serve the Namibian people and those who are doing business in Namibia.
Talking about those points of entry and about customs and excise, is it just counterfeit goods that would be seized or confiscated? Or, you know, and other than illicit goods, obviously, are there other reasons that NAMRA could confiscate imported products?
Oh, yes, definitely. The other reason could be you will find one of the challenges that we have in NAMRA, especially from a custom perspective, is undervaluation of imported goods and also non-declaration. You have many goods, people who are importing consignments of goods, and they would rather under-declare. You have a consignment having millions worth of goods, and it can be declared as far for a million or maybe 500,000. And that means revenue lost to the state. That's why. So you have misclassification of goods, because there is what we call a harmonized system that classify all the goods in the world so that you know for this specific product, this is how much it's supposed to be charged and so on. So they misclassify. The challenge that the Namibian government have been facing in NAMRA is misclassification, undervaluation, non-declaration. And sometime it then happened that a consignment can come in, and if our officer picked it up and found that there was a under-declaration or non-declaration, then the law also provide for the detention and seizure of those goods. And if the non-declaration or undervaluation has been then duly confirmed through our processes of ensuring proper valuation, once that is then done, a penalty will then be issued. So sometime, and it have to be settled within a period of 90 days, sometime many people may import goods, fail to declare or undervalue it, and once it's picked up and it's confiscated, there is a process that allows for such good to be forfeited to the state. And once it's forfeited to the state, it can then be disposed of through an auction, or sometime it can be donated. And those are some of the action that we have taken.
Finally, turning our attention back to NAMRA itself, the agency must be one of the most targeted entities as far as fraud. I mean, we've just been speaking about different types of fraud under declarations and things like that. But are there any current scams and fraudulent activities that the public need to be made aware of to ensure that their data and their online presence are safe?
Well, the target or the risk that Namibia Revenue Agency face, it's a global phenomena. All other agencies in the world, they face the risk that we are facing, especially the risk of fraud. And 3 months ago, we announced to the public, for example, that there was a scheme to defraud Namibia Revenue Agency, a scheme that started even before the launch of Namibia Revenue, where people are getting refunds that they're supposed not to get. These are people who are changing their tax status from individual taxpayer to provisional taxpayer, and they ended up creating some fictitious invoices, and they claim that they have how much they have spent expended on their farming activity, and they get the refund. That is one. We have the issue of around tripping. You know that if things are kept in the bond for export market, when things are in transit and they're in the bond to be exported, no customs duty is paid. And some of this goods, we found it that it get what is called round-tripped. So people work with some of the corrupt officials, and they create fictitious document to indicate if this thing have been exported out of Namibia, but they found itself in the Namibian market. We have noted of some people sending from fake email address to taxpayers and requesting them to pay or to ask some information, and later on try to coax them to pay. What we want to inform the Namibian people is that, and the taxpayers and all our clients out there, is that all our services are for free. And also, if there is any suspicious correspondences or communication trying to get money out of them, they must be able to find out, to confirm, or to contact our offices. We are everywhere. There's no region that we do not have a presence. Or they can contact info@namra.org.na and confirm, because there are really a lot of people there who have been targeting the tax office even before the launch of NAMRA. And the good thing is that we have, and we are working very hard to improve and develop our investigative capability and auditing. And that's why these schemes and these fraudulent schemes, we were able to pick it up from internal. We're working together with ACC. We're working together with the Namibian police. We are collaborating with FIC. So the future look very bright for Namibia. The future really look bright for Namibia, because the leakage that has been happening, we're going to put a stop on it. But of course, we will continue to have to work hard to ensure that the fair share of taxes and revenue due to the state is made available instead of being lost through these fraudulent activities.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shivutu. We wish you the best of luck.
Thank you very much, David. And I want to thank you for having me, and to all your listeners as well, just to say that Namibia Revenue Agency, we are there to serve with passion. We are committed to build a world-class revenue, saving with passion to positively impact the livelihood of every Namibian. Thank you very much.
That's David Bishop talking to Sam Shavuti, the NAMRA commissioner. So think twice before you fill in that return. Make sure that you are providing the correct information and that you have also the correct tax advice. That's the lead story here on the Business Report. And it was proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
Welcome back to the Business Report here on Nova 1035. And time now for our spotlight. Our spotlight shines on prominent Namibians who are making a difference, who are creating paths and doing the things that are required to build an economy here in the heartland of Africa. Our spotlight this evening shines on Martin Nkumbi, the Chief Executive Officer of the Development Bank of Namibia. Martin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So Martin, our first objective is always to try and find out where people are from. Tell us a little bit about where you were born, where you grew up, and a little bit about your childhood.
I was born in northern Namibia, in the region which is Omsati region, actually a village called Elim, which is just about 18 kilometers outside Oshakati. I grew up in my early teens in Oshakati, started primary school there. We moved to Windhoek. My mid-teens and the rest of my life, I have then lived in Windhoek from there on.
And what brought your family to Windhoek?
I actually grew up with an uncle and an aunt, which is quite normal in our culture. And they moved to Windhoek because my uncle got a job here. And then we moved to Windhoek. And then I continue with my primary schooling in Katutura, Namutoni Primary School.
And then high school and university?
High school, I went to DHPS. That was even about a year or 2 years before independence. Just before independence, it's a private school. German government decided to open it up to non-German speaking kids at the time. So I was one of the first 20 that enrolled at DHPS. I think it must have been 89, grade 8 then. That's when I went to DHPS, basically under the English medium branch. We would study English as the first language, Afrikaans second language, and German third language. And then from grade 10, we integrate with the rest of the German-speaking kids up to then grade 12 and grade 13, which is Deutsches Abitur.
So tell me a little bit about coming from a small village in the north of Namibia, primary school, into a German high school in the city. That's got to be almost like two entirely different worlds that for a young person is sometimes hard to reconcile. Tell me a little bit about your experience with that.
Yeah, it has been an experience. Yes, you rightly say, coming from the village, coming to Windhoek, white school, different culture, learning a completely different language. It has been an experience, a positive one though. And also it has been before independence, times were a little bit different, but it has been a good experience and I have learned much through that. I think I have been able to understand various cultures, so I think it has only built me.
What happened after school? People have different paths. What was your path?
Well, I have always been strong on the natural sciences, basically your physics, mathematics, chemistry. That has always been my area of strength in school. So my initial plan then in high school was either to study something like engineering or medicine. That was actually my focus area. So I'm actually ended up in banking and finance a bit by default. But I have enjoyed it then. It's quite close. I mean, it's mathematics is very important for finance and banking, which has always been my strength. So it was an easy way to get into that and doing what I'm doing now. And I'm still enjoying it. No regrets whatsoever.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about education in general. Mm-hmm. I get the privilege to speak to many people on this feature who have prominent positions. And I try and ask them, what is your view on the role of education in terms of being able to succeed in business?
Education is very important. I think it teaches you a way of thinking. That's key. Academic education is it's not necessarily alpha and omega, and obviously you can either go through a formal school system. You can also educate yourself thereafter in life by reading, by traveling, by listening to people asking questions. So that's all education. And I actually think that later on, that part of education where you're reading, where you're inquisitive, you know, where you're learning from other people becomes much, much more important than usually your formal education, where you simply sometimes, as it is often the case, you learn to replicate in a test or an exam. So, but nevertheless, education is very important. It enables you to think systematically. It will enable you to understand things. And therefore, whether you're going to be a business person, you need some level of education.
Okay. You say you arrived in banking and investment by default. Take us through that path. How did you wind up in the industry, and take us through where you've been?
Okay, yeah, that's quite an interesting part of my life. Yeah, as I mentioned, I schooled at DHPS. I mentioned earlier that my area of interest has always been the natural sciences, so engineering or medicine was what I was looking at. I was really not able to find money to go and study. At that time, UNAM there was actually something they called the Academy, which is now where NUST is now. So I was looking at universities in South Africa. I obviously didn't have funds to do so. And then at that time, Commercial Bank, now NetBank, it used to be Commercial Bank because it was owned by partly owned by Dresdner Bank, which is a German bank. They then advertised scholarships for Namibian students to go and study in the area of finance, banking, accounting, marketing. And I applied for one of those scholarships, and I was successful. So I decided to go and study BCom, Management Accounting and Finance, at the University of Cape Town. So I was successful. And that's how I ended up basically doing what I'm doing. So I then moved into banking. I graduated at UCT, and then I did an honors in finance and banking at the University of Natal, then KwaZulu-Natal now. And I worked for a year, basically, at a Commercial Bank, then before it became NetBank. And then the Central Bank was really looking for competent young people. It was just starting. I was one of those that was invited. They actually paid me out my scholarship at NetBank, and then I joined the Central Bank. And then I worked there in economic research and then our financial markets. And then I have moved later on, about after 5 years or so, to FNB Corporate Banking. Then I was in corporate banking for another 4 or 5 years before I joined Development Finance, so Development Bank. So that's my sort of career path.
That's a pretty broad background in banking. You've pretty much gone to all the good places.
Yeah.
So we're going to get into your current role after the break. But first, we're going to play a song. Tell us what song you've picked for the listeners.
All right. Well, I think in Namibia, we're blessed with quite a number of artists. I really think in that space, we are punching above our weight. So we have very competent or very artistic, especially lady artists. Some of my artists is either Sally, Post Madam, or Adora. This time, I'll pick a song by Adora, Pirikiti.
You make my heart go pity, pity, pom pom, yeah. pack our bags and take the train. Disappear, appear. You make my heart go beat-a-dee-bum-bum, yeah. 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 All I want you to see, you and I were meant to be, till forever you and me, I'll forever be your queen.
That's Adora here on Nova 103.5. It's the Business Report, and we're busy shining a spotlight on the Development Bank of Namibia's Chief Executive Officer, Martin Nkumbi, who's our guest this evening. Let's talk about the role of a development bank in a developing economy. The commercial banks tend to apply, as we know, Southern Africa, especially South Africa and Namibia, have a very strong commercial bank sector. The reserve banks still run very tight ships fiscally for the most part. Tell us a little bit about what role the development bank plays in the banking space.
The development bank is probably playing a role by obviously it's providing a role of providing financial capital to for enterprises and projects. And the DBNO is playing a role somewhere in between what commercial banks will lend money to and maybe what private equity investors will do, so somewhere in the middle. The main difference is really that the development finance institution is expected to take a bit more risk than a commercial bank in terms of lending longer term, maybe accepting a lower level of security for the loan they are advancing, providing flexibility in terms of structuring and restructuring loans. That's the main difference. Otherwise, the process and the due diligence of evaluating a business project is exactly the same, whether in commercial banking, investment banking, or development finance.
It's a little bit different because your shareholder obviously has different expectations of your role.
Correct.
Does that sometimes place you in a difficult space where you've got to weigh up what's important for the country, weigh up what's important for a community, and then weigh up what's important for your balance sheet and try and reconcile those three things?
Spot on. I would like to believe you have it exactly correct. The developmental role that is expected from the development bank poses a bit of a challenge. I always argue that one have to weigh up the need to be financially sustainable. Ultimately, it's a bank, and also the need to be relevant as a DFI. Otherwise, if you're not doing things a bit differently from a commercial bank, then there is not really much of a difference. And the difference is really that level of risk-taking, the flexibility, and ability to lend very, very long-term. And the development bank can do this because it's not regulated by the central bank, which puts certain prudential requirement and certain rules that commercial banks have to adhere to because they are managing depositors' money, public money. The development bank funds are, to a large extent, also public, seed capital that came from government, but it's also a bank. And there's a difference between a development fund and a development bank. A fund usually will get money from government and simply put it in projects and businesses. A development bank will get some funding from the shareholder government, but it's also expected to borrow and raise more money so that it can have a bigger impact. And that's what brings in a bit of complexity, because if you borrow money from international institutions, you need to manage your lending such that you are able to repay that money back. So that will bring you closer to operating like a commercial bank to some extent.
And how successful has the development bank been in raising outside funding?
Very successful, I would like to believe. The bank has been able to raise over $6 billion, the majority of it from the African Development Bank, part from KfW, which is a German development bank. And also, the bank has got a bond program on the Namibian Stock Exchange. So Namibian investors, especially institutional investors, that is pension funds, insurance companies, and so on, have confidence in the bank, and they have from time to time been able to invest in these instruments issued by DBN on the stock exchange. So DBN then get that money and unlend it into projects. So it has been successful.
The recent discoveries of oil, gas, and the much-hyped advent of green hydrogen, and then also the relatively slow but consistently developing sector of solar power and solar energy, there's this whole energy sector that's suddenly burgeoning or potentially could burgeon here in Namibia. This has got to be a wonderful opportunity for a bank like yours, which has a very different view on these big infrastructural type projects, to really sort of kick it up another notch and additionally raise significant outside funding for that as well.
Very true. I can start maybe just commenting on the latter, which is basically energy, especially renewable energy. The Development Bank has been a lead financier for this sector when it started about maybe 6-7 years back with the REFIT program. The bank has financed, I think, to now about 7 of this IPP, independent power producer, whether solar or wind. And the bank has got an exposure of about $1 billion to this sector, and it has done very well. To date, we have not experienced any delay in repayment of these loans to the bank. So the bank is a lead financier of that. Renewable energy is the thing across the world. Many lenders, international finance institutions are also willing to provide capital for this kind of project, which are producing basically clean energy, which is what we need, and that's the future. So it's an opportunity. And the good thing is it's actually driven by private sector, private entrepreneurs, many a times in partnership with international experienced technical partners. So it's a growing sector, and we will continue supporting it. And obviously, yes, energy, green hydrogen, the discovery of oil, I think that's just plus for our economy. Maybe in the long term, we're looking at probably 5 to 7 years when we can really see the fruits of some of these projects. But I think it's really a positive for our economy from my perspective.
Now, as a state-owned enterprise or state-owned business, I know there's a difference in terminology. Mm-hmm. Which are you?
DBN is a state-owned enterprise, which is simply meaning it's an enterprise that is owned by the government, which is the case. Bank is 100% owned by the government.
So as a state-owned enterprise, you're often also prone to the winds of changing political mindsets, perhaps divergent views. We know we operate in a global economy. Increasing Namibia might become more important in that global economy as our energy sector starts burgeoning. We're looking for export products. We are heavily reliant on our neighbors down south to keep the lights on. So there's a lot of stuff going on. And I guess what I'm curious, and we'll close the interview with this, what I'm curious on, what do you see as perhaps the one or two biggest challenges that the Namibian government has to navigate in actually developing this economy over the next 5 to 10 years?
I think specifically from the development finance perspective is government and even ourselves have to balance governance expectations in terms of influence. As a DFI dealing with other developmental partners, they are looking at us, the development bank, and asking the question, is this institution managed well in terms of governance? Is there too much government influence? That's always a question. Can a shareholder interfere in their business? But that has to be balanced. They need to be independent, especially in terms of decision making. And I think that is key. And I think Development Bank has really been able to maintain that. The shareholder government has always appointed, since I have been at the bank, independent directors. We never had directors that are government officials, and mostly from the private sector. And they make independent decisions in terms of how the bank is run, how lending decisions are made. And that is very important to make sure that there is fair decision-making process in the institution.
Martin, I'm going to release you back into the wilds to go and help develop the economy. Thank you very much for spending time with us this evening. And all the best with the very important role that the Development Bank has to play, especially as we look to this exciting next decade.
Thank you for inviting me. Pleasant day.
This evening's spotlight fell on the Development Bank of Namibia's Chief Executive Officer, Martin Nkumbi, who is our guest this evening. That's this evening's spotlight. And stay tuned. Next week, we'll be talking to someone just as interesting.
The Business Report. Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
The Biz News Ramp is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology and comfort. Book your test drive today at M&Z Motors. M&Z Motors is proud to introduce the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology and comfort. Contact M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group today for your test drive or visit the M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group Facebook page and check out their great offers. Jeep, go anywhere, do anything.
Welcome back to the Business Report. You're on Nova 103.5 and every week we go down south and we take a look at what's going on in South Africa, and our partners down there, biznews.com, were on the line with us tonight. Stuart Lyman. Stuart, welcome back to the show.
Always good to be here. Thanks, Gary.
Let's start out with the big news, and it looks like it's increasing in its ripple effect as more and more people come to grips with what has happened. But South African President Cyril Ramaphosa announced a raft of new measures, common sense regulations to deal with the energy crisis in South Africa. Tell us a little bit more about that and what's happened in the aftermath.
Thanks, Gary. I know last week we did mention the problems with the energy in the country, and you know we've had load shedding, which has been non-stop. But it's actually been quite good the last week and a bit, not much. But as you mentioned, as President Cyril Ramaphosa spoke on Monday evening, a lot of the reforms he actually talks about were things that the DA, Connie Mulder, the person from the Solidarity Research Institute, had actually mentioned. It's about opening up the market, in a sense, letting outside providers in, ending some of the caps on the renewable generation, etc. So, as you mentioned, common sense reform. It has been well received as well. Connie himself is a bit cautiously optimistic. He's concerned of what could happen with Eskom. As you know, a lot of the cadres earn a lot of money via Eskom, so there's a lot at stake here, and we have to see how it plays out. But I think, as Alec Hogmeyer, the founder of Business, mentioned in his newsletter this morning, some green shoots, which is well received by the South African community from what we can see at the moment. But let's see how these things play out. You know, there's been a lot of talk, so let's see the action. And when the action comes, hopefully, as I said, the lights will stay on for longer. A couple of the concerns, there's a lot of generation that needs to be put in place going forward. I know Franz Grenier, the former head of the RR, was speaking to Alec this afternoon. He says we still need to look at how we get to 20,000 megawatts. Where's that generation going to come from and things like that. So as we say, very, very not excited, but optimistic, and let's see how things play out.
Just from a business perspective, there's obviously a lot of businesses that are well positioned to take advantage of any new business opportunities or investment opportunities. We think of businesses like Renogen, and African Rainbow Capital itself has a number of energy investments that are well positioned. This might well be what provides a well boosted shot in the arm for foreign direct foreign investment in South Africa.
No, completely. I suppose you look at the listed companies so that everyday South Africans can look at where they can benefit from an investment point of view. And South Africa's always looking for FDR. So, yeah, there's many opportunities that I think will bear fruit. A lot of the renewables have seen investment already, so this is almost as if those investments can come true or come to form in a sense that they can plug in easily to the grid. And I think that's what people are excited about. I know we mentioned the DA mayor in Cape Town, Jordan Lewis, about how even residents could sort of play a part in that and earn sort of income if you've got a roof that generates lots of solar, as they say. So I think there's a lot of optimism, and I think there's opportunity around for most people.
Interesting story I ran into here in Namibia. We a lot of the business travel is to South Africa, so airlines and so forth are always of interest to us. Certainly the demise of SAA cut our choices quite significantly, as did the demise of the imminent, almost unavoidable demise of Comair and British Airways, the brand it operated. And just a really interesting story there by Sindile Vabaza about Comair, and it would seem that a fair amount of misfortune, but also a lot of blame to be tacked onto SAA for the demise of Comair.
Yeah, very interesting story. I was having to travel at least once a month between Joburg and Cape Town, you can see the challenges we have when airlines fall away. The cost of flights sort of skyrocket, and it's everyone's pocket. The Comair one, obviously, as you mentioned, the SAA sort of link is the finding that the provider actually helped travel agents commissions to divert customers away from Comair flights, and that was in a five-year stint from 01 to 06. And it looks like there was an amount of $383 million that was paid before SAA was declared insolvent. So I know my colleague Sandra sort of brought all together this like perfect storm that led to the demise of Comair. It was on, you know, the corruption side. It was the bad timing with the purchasing of the Boeing aircraft, you know, before COVID came. There was the two fatal crashes. So it was sort of an unfortunate perfect storm, which the consumers bear the brunt of, less competition there, more out of pocket.
Of course, we've seen Fly Namibia also, or rather Air Namibia also, disappear. And that's given rise now to Air Link being a primary link into South Africa, and Fly Namibia, a newly branded local operator who does lots of domestic flights. Are we seeing new operators poking their heads out in South Africa? That always seemed to be a space where a budding entrepreneur could go lose a few billion quite quickly.
Yeah, it's an industry I'm not sure I put my own dollar into with the control you have over oil prices, etc. But Gidon Novik launched Lyft not too long ago, which has done quite well. It's just one route, Cape Town to Joburg at the moment. But he was looking at other routes that potentially could work out. It's a very different approach to sort of purchasing of flights that Lyft does. But I see he's on the SAA side, you know, the rebirth of SAA with the Harith consortium who is going through the deal there to potentially take it over and run it with sort of the public enterprises. So I'm not sure how that would interrupt his current venture. But Lyft is a good one. I haven't seen it. There's nothing else I could report back on. But let's see. Let's hope.
Okay. And then health issues. An article written there by Robert Malone on the site and contextualized by Nadia Swart, called Monkeypox or Moneypox, Dr. Robert Malone on Tedros's unilateral declaration of another public health emergency. It is interesting, only 5 deaths to date, and of course any death is tragic, but many more people have died probably of falling over in the last while. 14,000 cases of monkeypox. So clearly the disease is spreading, and it's not a new disease, but perhaps give us a little bit of background on this. I think there's overwhelming public skepticism now suddenly about emerging health crises, and how much danger does that put in how we deal with these things?
Yeah, it's interesting. I just did a bit of research around this as well before we came on air. And on the CDC website, they look at the vaccine effectiveness. And obviously, monkeypox closely relates to smallpox, which is a big thing back in the day. But they reckon there's about 85% effectiveness in preventing monkeypox if you've had a smallpox vaccine. So it's a strange one, this variant. Like you said, I think the problem with it is it creates more skepticism around, given the COVID issues we had, you know, with lockdowns, et cetera, et cetera. I think there's a lot of concern with the reach that certain people have. But yeah, it's strange. It's a difficult one to understand. I know you also mentioned the 14,000 cases. I mean, that was what COVID were getting how many on a daily basis. You know, it seems like a very small affair and a bit of overreach with regards to the World Health Organization on this one. And I'm not sure how else where we go with it. But I think with people like Dr. Robert Malone, there's going to be a lot of querying with any decision made by certain organizations going forward.
And of course, it does. I mean, it does place this whole issue of vaccines into stark contrast. We're seeing outbreaks of measles and of serious measles and polio in developed countries where theoretically these diseases have no right to exist anymore. And in some cases had been declared kind of gone, largely as a result of non-vaccination, almost solely as a result of non-vaccination. And then the WHO does, or the World Health Organization does this, which places this whole issue of vaccination again at the forefront of kind of corporate weirdness, or perhaps, you know, the conspiracy guys who run around saying this is the Illuminati wanting us all to jab microtransmitters into our veins. But it has the very real sort of perhaps ripple effect of malbalancing, certainly when we were growing up, what seemed now to be a very healthy reliance on the vaccines that existed to protect young children from totally preventable diseases. This kind of thing, an overreach, has the potential to tip that little cart of apples over as well.
No, for sure. I mean, Gary, if you look at sort of corporate profits, you know, you can really dig deep into this. You know, look at Pfizer, how COVID vaccinations drove those numbers. So there's a lot of skepticism. And I suppose the concern, not being a health expert, is, as you say, you go too much to one side, you lose out what you gained on the other side. And it's, yeah, because vaccines have worked in the past. And unfortunately, I think the skepticism started because these vaccines didn't work in a way that the previous vaccines worked. You know, they didn't prevent COVID. They just prevented the symptoms of COVID. So in effect, was it a vaccine? Is it the true definition of a vaccine? And then you've created this whole skepticism around vaccinations so let's see what happens. Unfortunately, I probably can't comment too much on what happens in the future, but we're going to have to wait and see what happens with this one.
Important just to note, there have been reported cases of monkeypox in South Africa and none yet in Namibia, but given the amount of travel between the two countries, it's hard to see that doesn't happen. So we'll keep an eye on that story as well. Stuart, that's what we've got time for tonight. Always a pleasure chatting to you. Thank you so much. Glad to see the lights are still on. Let's hope they're on next week. And maybe next week you've got a little solar panel up and you can start making a few cents back from the municipality.
That sounds good. Thanks as always. Okay, keep up.
That's Stuart Lohman from our partners in South Africa, biznews.com. You can check out those stories and many, many more. Some fascinating stories on there and lots of opinion pieces as well that I'm sure will spark debate around any briar fire. That's on biznews.com. And that's it for this week's BizNews Weekly Wrap.
The BizNews Wrap is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology, and comfort. Book your test drive today at M&Z Motors.
Gary Strubel on the Business Report.
Welcome back to the Business Report here on Nova 103.5, and time now for Market Watch. And for our Market Watch, for the market selected this evening, we look at small, medium-sized enterprises and the development side of our economy. Now, the Namibia Investment Promotion and Development Board has launched the Know to Grow High Potential Pool to support high-potential micro and small businesses to showcase their offerings. Joining us in studio this evening, Dino Bellotti, the SME Development Innovation and Acceleration Head at the NIPBD, joins us this evening. Dino, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
So it's a cool name, Know to Grow. Let's start out with that. What does the MSME High Potential Pool Project entail? It's a long title.
Yeah.
Let us know what it's about.
No, thank you. We love acronyms, so we have a bunch of them. So if we think of Know to Grow, that's our sort of flagship offering of all the sort of impact work that we're trying to achieve and put together. And so under the Know to Grow banner, we launched an information dissemination project at the beginning of the year. We've seen just under 3,000 micro and small businesses thus far. which we think has really been impactful. And we've now identified what we call the high potential pool, aka HP squared. And really this is, how do we get these businesses on international platforms and get the guys with the bucks, which is the banks, to partner with us so that we can do more? So we launched it a couple of days back. So I think it's been a great success, the whole sort of journey. But now we can do more impact work, which is why we're there.
Okay, so let me take a step back. So cool. It's been a bit like a reality show, right? You said to guys, come and pitch us. You've seen, I would imagine, an enormously wider range of different sorts of pitches, from abysmal to highly impressive.
Yeah.
You've picked a bit of a dream team. And the idea is to expose that to direct foreign investment opportunities?
Yes. So if we think about this high potential pool, which is really what we're talking about now, we haven't yet put the businesses in this pool. So it would be naive of us to say we know already which businesses form part of it. I think through our exercises over the past couple of months, we've identified a gap. And that gap is really the funding or the access to money to actually go on international missions, to showcase the offering in SADC, in Africa, you know, in the world. So if we talk about the work that we've been doing, we went on an information pickup journey toward the end of last year, or the familiarization trip, if you may. And we spoke to leadership of the country. So all the local authorities, town council, CEOs, mayors, governors, and through that engagement, we've identified where are the bottlenecks, where is more support needed. And as you mentioned, it really is a dream team. It's a great bunch of Namibians in our space. And really we're saying now, how can we do as much as possible and coordinate better? So I think the name of the game is really coordination. If we can do this at scale, we need more private-public partnerships to get it done. And that really forms the basis of the high potential pool.
So tell us, give us a bit of a range of what sorts of businesses are these that sit in the pool?
Awesome. So if we think of MSME, micro, small, and medium-sized enterprises, I think policy definition really speaks to the turnover number. So your micro under 300K per annum and your small under 3 million bucks per annum turnover. So we're really only identifying the micro and the small businesses in this space. And we're saying now you need to have high potential. It's probably a subjective way of looking at it. Again, you could be turning over nothing. You could be a startup. You could be highly innovative. You could be in a remote area where no one's doing what you're doing. So there is a bit of a criteria as to how to get into this pool. It'll probably only have between 50 and 100 businesses in this sort of pool, but the handholding and the access to international opportunities will be probably a bit more than just any other business that knocks on the door. And the idea is over a 36-month period, we need to scale you to become a medium-sized enterprise. If after that 36 months we've not been able to achieve this, then we failed. We're putting money into this project, so we really need to give. We can use examples. We went to the Inter-Africa Trade Fair in Durban last year, November. Because of, you know, budget, it's your tax money, or our tax money rather, we could take three businesses with us. We had a Namibian pavilion. All three of those businesses got uptake by physically being there. And it's those platforms where if we can showcase more businesses can get buyers.
So give us a sense, those businesses that went along, what did they do? What is their business?
So there's been a couple of initiatives. Durban is one. We went to the Fielda Luanda most recently in Angola. There's been the Expo Dubai. So there's been a couple.
No, I mean, the guys you took with, those businesses have got uptake.
Yeah, yeah. So those specific ones, in our opinion, they were highly scalable. So I think when we talk about MSME, we talk about scalability. If you don't have the potential to create more jobs and to really grow, then possibly we're not going to spend as much time supporting you. So those three ones, I guess to name them, the one was called Black Gold Engineering, and really that's a patented, locally produced energy-saving light bulb.
Okay.
So when you talk of local authority streets, you know, the African market, I mean, that's a huge thing for us to, and that patent is in different continents. So, I mean, everyone was dying to get access to this light bulb, which is also for street lights and I think it's called downlighters. The second one was Y-Shaps, which is a very innovative chemistry laboratory in a box. So think of with your bucky, you're towing something. There's a laboratory that folds up and you can take that into remote areas. So the access to these STEM sort of subjects, the science, technology stuff, they would not have access because of lack of money, the schools, and this could be scaled into SADC, into Africa. The third one was wood and charcoal, but we really liked his model of empowering young people. So those three businesses specifically, there was quite an extensive criteria that we tried to go through. And we thought these are the three that at that platform we can showcase.
All right.
But there are hundreds and thousands of really, really exciting businesses.
But it is useful to know that it's not just some guy with an app. It's there's some technology in there.
Yeah.
There's some real entrepreneurship with packaging things up to solve community problems.
That's right.
There's a very traditional product that everyone utilizes with a different business model to it. So there's a range of different things that guys can look at, but it has to be able to scale. So,
that's right.
You know, the answer is always around small businesses. If you're a standalone hairstylist, that's not going to scale unless you've created some great product in that 100%. Space. So it's innovation we're looking for.
100%. I think in terms of the international definition of a startup, there's always a technology element. And in a Namibian context, we can't only use startups with tech. We don't have internet in every single town, right? So we're very conscious of our Namibian context, but the name of it is really scalability. So, I mean, my father's a small business owner, one employee, which is himself, and he's okay. He can make a few coins and he can survive. But that wouldn't be the business that we're really trying to help scale. So guys that can create 10, 30, 40, 50 jobs quickly, those are the ones that we say this can really be the fix. So again, Namibian companies solving Namibian and global problems. So that's, it's a subjective one when you ask me, how do you select these businesses? I think we really just look at all sectors of the economy, all the regions. His Excellency's mantra, no one should be left behind, that rings in our ears constantly. So even if you'd have no access to internet and your car wash is quite scalable, we're going to try and work with you and help you.
Yeah. Okay. The principal objective here is there's a couple of aspects to it. One of them is to promote entrepreneurship as a way of life.
Yeah.
All right. So we're not reliant on state employment or the private sector. There's a third way to create a future. Second is to create employment for others. And then third, to be able to put Namibia at the forefront of direct foreign investment, to be able to bring capital inflows into the country. All of those three things work together to form a perfect storm. Am I right? That's
100%.
That's the ideal that you're aiming at.
Yeah, no, that's the golden thread.
And to do that, you have to have, I mean, you're going to have to throw a lot of spaghetti at the wall, because typically in this space, there's also an incredibly high failure rate.
Yeah.
So in selecting 50 or 100, that's still quite a big number to have to manage and work with it.
Got you.
What sort of resources and facilities do you guys have at your disposal to do this?
So we don't have enough bucks, right? we I think everyone will say they need more budget and this and that. So we really try and be resourceful. I think that's just the honest truth. With what we have, can we do more? And I'll use South Africa quickly as an example. So their MSME ministry probably has 1 billion rand as their budget. And we have a few millions in the MSME mandate of the board. When they have an incubation center, we physically were shown how it works. They take 40 small businesses. They incubate them for a year, and that whole cost of exercise is probably about 10 to 15 million rand. Now, if we spend $1 million, we need to at least see 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 Namibian businesses. So we contextually, we need to do a lot more. So when you ask me, with these 50 or 100 entrepreneurs or scalable businesses, how much resource do you put into that? We couldn't do it alone.
Mm.
So we got the five big banks, Lecheco and the other big four. I should probably name them on the show. So FNB, Standard Bank, Bank Vintuk, and Nedbank. We told them the story. They bought into it. They said, we love it. Let's partner. And I think it's these kind of collective exercises where private sector say, so a practical example, Dino's Dogs is a small business. And I'm at FNB. If I want to go and show Dino's Dogs in Botswana at some other fair, FNB would actually say, you know what, we're going to subsidize Dino to go. Because if I do well, FNB does well.
Absolutely.
So I think it's just, it works like that. So we're really excited about it. And I think the project is aimed to just scale these high potential businesses. Yeah.
So I'm going to throw a tough question at you.
Please.
Now. One of the critical aspects that's come up time and time again with people we've spoken to on the show about small business development, about entrepreneurship, startup, and so forth, it's just the enormous amount of red tape that sits within a Namibian context to get a business registered, get your license documents, get your tax documents. It's incredibly burdensome. And we know that there's one or two institutes that are perhaps more burdensome than others. I'm assuming one of the things you guys are able to bring to bear is a little bit of sharp scissors to cut some of that red tape.
Correct. So, you know, in as much as we can't do this alone, we're acutely aware that we need the support of all of government. And I think we've got that. So, I mean, as a small business owner, possibly myself, or having been involved in some initiatives, we understand some of the challenges. But I think as an entrepreneur, these guys and girls, these are the real champions of Namibia. It's tough to be an entrepreneur. Mm. And being a business owner, I mean, you have to feed miles at the end of every month. So the respect that we have for these guys, they really say, you know what, as private sector, not everyone can work for a bank or for financial services or O&L, whoever it might be. So we need these micro and small businesses to create these jobs. So when you talk of that bureaucracy and red tape, I think we're not trying to solve. Somebody put it recently, it's the ministry of heaven and earth. We're not that ministry, right? but genuinely, if we can add value, I mean, just today we had a really great conversation with a commercial bank that's about to launch something super exciting in Namibia. And we said, we're possibly not the best partner, but we can add value to what you're trying to do because it's going to speak to our sector or our mandate. So I think in saying this, when people really feel grieved by something not working, you know, let's have a conversation.
Okay.
It might not happen immediately, but let's have that conversation. And if we can unlock opportunities, that's why we're here. We are here to collaborate with private and public sector.
Okay. So I'm a small business owner. I've been listening to Nova because they play the coolest tunes.
There we go.
And because, of course, they love this show. And I'm now super excited. Dino's my man. He can solve all my problems. I've got this great idea. Is there still space for people to come into the
100%.
Net? How do
so
they get
we've
hold
put
of
no
you?
One in this pool as yet. And I tell you that honestly, there's no cousins or family members that are going in there. It's a really objective process to get businesses to form part of it. But I think step number one, if you're a business owner, register with the MSME division. We can plug you in to the mega projects, the hyphen green hydrogen.
Okay, you're saying that. Yeah. What is that? Wait, how do they get hold of the SMME division or department?
So I mean, NIPDB is probably a tongue twister, but the Namibia Investment Promotion Development Board, there's the portal, the website.
Okay.
I think that's the easiest one for now. Go on there. There is a MSME sort of page or link, and there's a way to register your business. It's a really quick process.
Right.
Once you're registered, you're on our database. When you're on the database, we put you into, or we try to plug you into projects. So we would know what sector you're operating in, which region, which town, etc. And I think that's when the opportunities come. So as a starting point, just make sure that you're registered. And if nothing is working, you know, my name is Dino Bolotti, just somehow get hold of me. We have a team and the whole team is there to support.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when do we expect this ultimate survivor pool to be filtered down to the winners?
Yeah. So it's not really a winner's exercise, right? So I think
facetious,
it'll probably be, you know, 50, 60 guys for now. And there'll always be space for high potentials. But we're not trying to fool ourselves and put 3,000 businesses in there and say we're going to support all 3,000 with hand-holding. So, you know, at any given time, people need to make us aware of what they're doing. There's investors that are constantly knocking on the door. And if it's a linkage that we can play, then let us play that role. If it's a red tape that needs to be cut, if it's support, we don't have money, so don't ask us for funding, but we can connect you to financing. And I think sometimes that's the value. Do people know that there's a credit guarantee scheme of government? Do they know that you don't need collateral for this up to $1 million loan? Possibly they don't. And that's where we play a role of coordination and value addition. So register with us for the HP Square or high potential pool. In the next coming months, we'll probably say who they are. And then we need to be accountable. We really need to support these guys to have international opportunities within the budget constraints. You can imagine sending one MSME to Angola, which Luanda is probably of the most expensive cities in Africa, it's probably going to cost you $30,000-$40,000 Namibian. It's flights, it's accommodation, it's stipend. So, you know, you do the math. You can't send everyone on international mission. But one thing I wanted to mention, and I think with high potential pool, it's the international business linkages. It's the subsidized financial support for trade missions. It's also, if we talk about export training or business advisory, even coaching and mentorship, there's different elements to this high potential pool. And it's not to say we're diluting all the other work that we're doing. We're just saying that we're going to have a more focused approach to really scalable businesses that can create employment, bring bucks into Namibia, and just do great things.
We want to start firing things out of that cannon and seeing where they land. So, Dino, just lastly, I mean, this must be exhausting in seeing you would see a lot of bad ideas. You would see a lot of people who are very passionate about things that are clearly never ever going to fly. And you would also see people with some tremendous things. So at the same time as being exhausting, it must be exhilarating to just see how much untapped potential sits there.
Yeah.
You sound quite excited by it all.
You need to be passionate about what you do. And I think the team and I, you know, entrepreneurship and business development, it runs in the blood. So if we can help scale, I don't say one business, I'll probably get fired. But if we can scale some businesses that can create jobs, those are the success stories that just keep us going. And it's not to say there's bad ideas. It's to say, can we add value to what you're trying to do? It's all contextual. The community of Tsumkwe might be Namibia's most sort of poverty-struck community. But it doesn't mean that there's not good ideas coming out of that area. I mean, we have the benefit of being in the capital with access to all the sort of big players. But there's never really a bad idea. It's really can. And sometimes we're quite honest. We can't add value.
Sure.
And we need to be honest about that. But definitely, if you knock on our door, there must be something we can assist, support, connect you to. And even it's just part of the ecosystem. So Dino's Dogs, again, there might be an investor that's interested in dogs. And he or she would say, well, someone dealing with this, we need to have that conversation. And I think of Expo Dubai, we had an MSME catalog of about 400, you know, businesses that applied. And it was a catalog. They weren't physically at the expo. But a number of them came back to us and said, you know, I got some really weird international emails or calls and they had interest in my business. So it's putting them on those platforms where, you know, the greater world can say, well, I'm actually interested in this business that you're operating in. So that's our role of coordination. You know, let's have this chat again in 12 months. And you say, well, probably sooner if there's something else to talk about. But in 12 months, say, guys, how's it gone? You know, of those 50 businesses, tell us a story. And I promise you, we won't pay the guys to tell a good story. But the hope is that a large majority of them can say, wow, these opportunities have helped us. We had ease at the launch, Eric Zell. And I mean, that comment rings, it was a couple of days ago. He said he wishes this project was around 20 years ago when he started, because he had to help himself get into the German and the European market alone. And if we can help to get products into other markets, then that's the real win.
Well, you've heard it here on the Business Report. That's the Know to Grow High Potential Pool that was launched by the Namibia Investment Promotion and Development Board. If you've been fired up, you can get along to their website. You can go register there under that program. Dino Bellotti, the SME Development, Innovation and Acceleration Head at NRPD. Thank you so much for joining us, Dino. All the best with this enormously important work you're doing. And
awesome.
We're not going to let that much time go past before we hold you to account.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
That is this evening's Market Watch here on the Business Report.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Nova 1035.
Good evening, Graham. Yes, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome.
Thanks, Angie. Thanks for having me.
So, yes, Graham, you've just launched your new business, BizVal. Tell us a bit about BizVal.
Well, Angie, BizVal was really born out of a need. You know, my partners and I both worked with small businesses for a number of years. And one of the things, you know, small businesses struggle with is access to affordable services, you know, whether it's accounting services or valuation services. And, you know, we set about trying to solve a problem for small business owners. And that was, you know, they always had this question is, what am I building and what's it worth? And usually those kind of services are out of reach. You know, you can get an accounting firm and they will charge you, you know, thousands of rands to be able to, rands and $1 million to be able to do that. And in our case, we wanted to make that easy and accessible for business owners to get a scorecard for their business. And also a tool, you know, whether doing retirement planning or whether we're doing something like wanting to buy or sell a business, that you could quickly and easily get a valuation for your business without having to go through lots of hoops and lots of expense.
Graham, maybe you can tell us, how does it work? Can Namibians also, you know, join? Maybe you could explain that to us.
100%. So I think the beauty of BizVal is it's accessible and it's global. So, you know, whether you're Namibian, South African, British, it works anywhere in the world. Obviously, in the back end, we've got a whole bunch of logic that allows it to perform a valuation that's accurate in your country. So essentially what you do is you go to the BizVel website, which is bizvel.co. You click on, you know, create a profile. You create a profile for yourself. And then you can purchase one or multiple valuations. And then essentially what you do is we ask you 20 to 25 questions about your business. So you don't need to be an accountant. All you need to do is understand your business, some of the basic drivers about your business. And you go through a series of questions. It takes no longer than 15, 20 minutes tops. You need to know some info. I mean, obviously, what your sales are, what some of your costs are. But the beauty about it is it's saved as you go along. So you can start. If you've got a question, if you do need to check in with your accountant or something, you can come back a little bit later and finish it off. Once you've done that, it gives you an opportunity to check all your inputs. And instantly, it runs in the back end, and you'll have a valuation answer within seconds of submitting your results. So then what you get effectively is a printout, which gives you a valuation of your company. It gives you some tips on how you can actually improve that valuation. And it gives you a bunch of different methodologies in terms of how that valuation is calculated. Some of them have different sort of use cases. But essentially, it's as simple as that.
It sounds really simple and safe as well.
Absolutely. Obviously, in this world, the things like data security are a must. So we have full encryption in the back end, you know, password protection, and we take it incredibly seriously. You know, so from a safety and security point of view, that's, you know, 100%.
Graham, thank you so much for talking to me.
Angie, thanks for having me. It was always a pleasure to talk to you, and we'll have to chat again soon.
Definitely. Thank you.
It's the Business Report with Gary Struble. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Novo 103.5.
I'm David Bishop with your weekly economics wrap. Swapo Party leadership in the Otjiwarongo district joined the nearly 200 striking workers of the Cheetah Cement Factory who allege unfair labor practices. Oshona Governor Elia Irimari has called out those who are resorting to the selling and purchasing of illegal fuel from neighboring Angola, saying that in doing so, taxes for the Road Fund Administration will be slashed and therefore government might find it hard to upgrade and maintain the country's planned and existing road infrastructure. The Ministry of Environment, Forestry and Tourism says the country received over 270,000 foreign arrivals last year, compared to 192,000 in 2020. Of this, 86% were tourists, with South Africa, Germany and Zambia the highest contributors. Still in Namibia, and Deputy Executive Director in the Ministry of Higher Education, Training and Innovation, Dr. Raymond Nanda, has urged Namibian corporate companies to join the call of absorbing students seeking internship programs to complete their studies. The latest quarterly GDP figures show that Namibia's agriculture sector grew by 5.9% year-on-year in the first quarter of 2022. Finance Minister Ipumbu Shimi has appointed a 19-member technical committee to spearhead consultations on the protracted Financial Institutions and Markets Act. And the country has reportedly joined the cryptocurrency frenzy with the introduction of the country's first Bitcoin automated teller machine at which customers can buy or sell Bitcoin and Ethereum. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has cautioned against Africa's reliance on European countries for essential food commodities, saying that Russia's invasion of Ukraine had left African countries with little choice but to start producing food themselves. He has also called for an economic summit to examine the key challenges facing the country. And still with Ramaphosa, the president on Monday night announced new emergency measures to deal with the country's electricity crisis, urging people to do their bit by installing solar power, avoiding illegal connections, and using electricity sparingly. Looking at the rest of Africa, Zimbabwe is to introduce a gold coin aimed at battling a resurgence in inflation and ease the public's thirst for US dollars, while also shoring up the economy at a time of galloping inflation and depreciation of the Zimbabwean dollar. Rwanda has been exploring the use of gas from Lake Kivu for cooking, industrial use, and vehicles. And the International Monetary Fund on Tuesday said that Egypt needed to make decisive progress on fiscal and structural reform as Cairo seeks a new round of support from the fund. Internationally, Jan Hoffman, the head of trade logistics at the UN Trade and Development Body, UNCTAD, says the Ukraine war has compounded severe strains on global supply chains, explaining that with more than 80% of goods moving by sea, space on ships is tight and the cost to transport a container has soared. And Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has begun a tour of Africa with the aim of boosting cooperation with the continent amid the war in Ukraine and the confrontation with the West.
Namibia's business leader on Nova 103.5.
Another great week of stuff from the team here at the Business Report. Thanks to David for catching up with Sam Shavuti. And tax, a big issue, and I think you can expect much more on this story. And typically where it starts is some high-profile guy gets bust for tax, and then that breaks things wide open. Watch out for that. Thanks so much for joining us this evening. Our thanks, as always, to the team. Angie Skoltz, our tireless producer, David Bishop, for all his contributions, Raymond Ziefeld, our technical producer, and to all our guests for joining us on the show, but also to you for tuning in and making this Namibia's number one business show. You can get hold of us on email. That's tbr@nova.com.na. You can also check out this episode if you missed something or want to hear more of it, or send it on to someone. And all of our previous episodes, you can get on nova.com.na under podcasts. You can also check us out on Twitter and follow stories that are posted there as well. Thanks for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll catch you again, same time, same place, next week.
That was the Business Report on Nova 1035. Listen to all the segments and previous episodes with our podcast service on nova.com.na. The Business Report was presented by Gary Struble and produced by Angie Skulls and David Bishop. Comments and questions can be sent to tbr@nova.com.na.